hand these out or just have them handy or whatever, but a piece of paper, pen, everything. If you want to write a question for us to discuss that night, you can do that. You can write down the question. All right. So last time we talked quite a bit about the whole margin, like emotional margin and that kind of stuff, and how that plays into marriage and why marriage satisfaction scores drop as starting at around 5 to 7 years and then start climbing and then dropping. And we talked about all of that stuff. I don't think I left any of that off. We went all the way to the end of that conversation. Did anybody have any, anybody who was here who remembers that, have any comments or questions about how that plays out any further? Was there any confusion or questions or something I needed to clarify? Because we kind of ended by running out of time. So if there was anything, I want to make sure we cover that or talk about that. So that is what plays out from the, if you are different, the differences you and your spouse have, the energy that it takes to tolerate someone who is different from you is that emotional energy. And so you start with a certain amount every day, and that changes based on kids and stress and other turmoil and pain and any number of things like that, the amount of stress that you're in. You start with a certain number of points. Some of that gets set aside for certain things. It automatically gets segmented off. This is how many my patients need. This is how many my clients need. This is how many our dog needs. This is how much of it my kids need. And so fun and romance is a type of fun, friendship is a type of fun, are done in the margin with what's left over. Now, there's another way to create margin that I may not have talked about. And the other way to create margin is to impose it. And so in the same way that if you say, listen, we have no money, none. At the end of the month, we have more month than we have money, and we are just, we're done as far as when it comes to finances. And the IRS contacts you and says, you have to start paying us $50 more a month or you're going to prison. You will say, I guess I'll find 50 more bucks, right? And so what you do is you then just impose a $50 fee into the midst, and somehow you reshuffle things. Well, that's the same way that if you want to have a successful romantic relationship with somebody, like marriage is intended to be, you're going to have to do that. In today's world, if you love something, you must schedule it. Scheduling something is not a sign of a lack of love, it is a sign of love. It is an expression of love to schedule something. Now, you might not even let the other person know you're scheduling it. That's not necessary. If it's important for them to feel like it is impetuous, then just don't tell them you're scheduling it. That's okay. That you would just say, listen, my clock goes off at a certain time every day. Text your wife. And so I text my wife. And that's not because I don't love to talk to my wife or whatever. It's because I know that it's easy that I could get distracted and not go a whole, I could go a whole day and not text my wife, not communicate with her at all. I've got so much going on and it's so busy and so much that that could easily happen. But I know that that's not healthy for her, and it's a sign of love for her if I do that. And so I need to discipline myself to remember that. It's the way I buy. So you'll know, guys, this is a big secret I'll let out of the bag here. If you want to be a good gift giver, I mentioned that what a gift has to have in order to be a good gift for a woman, and that is that it communicates to her that you know her and that you're thinking about her when she's not around. Those are the two things that a gift has to have in order to be a great gift for a woman. But if you want to be good at that, there's only one way to do that, and that is when you see something that is a good gift for your wife, get it. Like, don't think about it, don't strategize, don't like, hey, when could I give this to her? Get it. If she's with you, distract her, throw something at her feet, send her out to the car, and get it. And then, because what will happen is you'll get slammed with stuff and you'll be busy, and then suddenly it will be your anniversary, or suddenly it will be her birthday. Or worse, even, and here's the problem, by suddenly, I mean in 2 weeks. So you realize, oh my gosh, our anniversary is in 2 weeks. If a lot of men, it'll be 2 hours. That's the amount of, oh my gosh, our anniversary is tonight. That's why she's asking me out. Like, oh wait, we're going on a trip this weekend because it's our anniversary. Like, that'll be the first, for some guys, that'll happen. For some women, that's the way too. So the problem is, if you wait until 2 weeks before Valentine's or 2 weeks for her birthday to shop for her, what happens? Guys, what happens? You can't find anything, right? And you're going, I know she's hinted at like 50 things she wanted, like, but I can't remember any of them. I don't remember what she wanted. I'm going to end up getting something lame, and she's going to give me that look. Like, you don't know me at all, do you? When I give this to her, like, have you been married to me or someone else? Like, you don't know that I don't like that? And that's what's going to happen, because 2 weeks is not enough time to remember what was important to her. And so I will tell you guys, when it is 2 weeks out from an event when I need to get a gift, I don't go to the store and start shopping. I go to my closet. And I dig through the stacks of gifts that I have bought. And I don't have any. You ask me right now, Chris, what kind of gifts do you have for your wife in your closet? I have no idea. But what would happen is I would then, I'm going on a trip next week. I need to leave some special little prizes for her during the week while I'm gone. When am I supposed to go shopping for that kind of stuff? Well, I just go to my closet and dig through, and I will find a bag full of those and go, oh, she really wanted this. She was crazy about that. So I'm telling you, that's the way to do it. No extra charge. Any other, in regards to, that all has to do with margin. So you take care of the things that communicate best with the minimal resources that you have. You have minimal time, minimal money, minimal energy, even minimal brain power very often to focus in on this relationship, especially once you have kids, especially when they're infants or toddlers or teenagers. There just isn't much margin. And so if you don't handicap yourself in some way, you'll just fail. And this goes in both directions. So if you're like the typical couple, about 70% of the time, men notice the lack of sexual encounters before the woman does. That's only about 70-30. We portray that as though it's 100%, but it's not. So that's one of the things I always like saying, that is because if you're one of those couples that the woman notices the lack of sexuality before the husband does, you feel like a circus freak at every church marriage conference you've ever been to. That they're like, isn't this always the case? And everyone's laughing except you. And you're like, no, we're not only just messed up, we're like doubly backwards messed up. So that's not the case. It's about a 70-30. It's not that uncommon. But if you are like in that typical situation, then it's the same thing can often be true the other direction, that the woman or whoever it is who does not notice the lack of sexuality first has to discipline themselves to think about it. Because anything that doesn't come naturally to you is a discipline. And so whatever it is that doesn't come naturally to you, you have to somehow discipline yourself. You schedule it, you get accountability, you create a plan, all the different things you do for anything that is discipline-oriented. Discipline is not a lack of love. That is a crock of BS from today's culture. That if you don't feel it, it's not real. And let me just tell you, by definition, if you're connecting something to emotions, it's not real. That's what makes it not real. So authentic means the same across time, right? Sincere means the same no matter under what conditions. By definition, can you have something be authentic because you feel it? What's the one thing that's true of emotions? They change across time. That's one of the things you know for sure. It's one of the ways that counselors, part of how psychologists, how we get away with a lot of stuff we do. If you come to my office and you're terribly depressed, I mean, you're just terribly depressed, the law of diminishing returns works in my favor. I can say almost anything and say, come back next week, and I think if you do this, you'll feel better, right? Well, the truth is, you can't feel like this for a week. And so almost certainly a week from now, you're going to feel some better. Now, hopefully, I'm also giving you tools that help you do all kinds of other things better, but the law of diminishing returns is in my favor at that moment. Any medicine you give to the most depressed people is an antidepressant, because they're going to be less depressed in a week. Because no one stays that depressed. You can't be at the bottom for long, like you only a little amount of time. So that, I have no idea why I was talking about that. Wednesday's a long day to be trying to teach. What's that? Authenticity. Thank you. So, now the same thing, whatever it is you feel, I need some people who have memories to help me out with that kind of stuff. So what happens is, if you feel saying it's only real because you feel it, then understand, by definition, whatever you feel right now is something you won't feel soon. So if you're happy right now, I feel confident that at some point in the near future, you won't be happy. The good news is, if you're really sad, I'm convinced that at some point in the near future, you'll be happy. That was why I stopped asking clients in counseling what their goals were. Because Eric's right here. Third row back. Because if they... he's kind of slouched, so you're not going to spot him. If he's sitting up straight, he'd be obvious, but kind of slouched. If you're waiting to feel something to make a moral decision or an ethical decision or a right decision, then you're going to be halfway making decision and your emotion is going to change again. You cannot trust how you feel to be how you make decisions. If you get to, that's awesome. Sometimes God allows that. Sometimes you get to make love to your spouse when you're feeling that way. And when that's the case, hey, that's just bonus. But if we always start there until I feel what I feel, I don't move forward, then you're going to be terrible at marriage. That's a big part of why our marriages are failing so badly, is because we think that things like that depend on how we feel. And that's just a huge, huge error. Even things like that, even things like sexuality, even things like faithfulness, even things like going on a date or whatever. I mean, there are times for doing that when you don't feel like it. And in fact, like I said, when you've got young children or teenagers, you're not going to feel like it. And so it's just, regularly you're not going to feel like it. They're going to have sucked all the emotional energy out of your life. The joy will be just, it'll be just bleak because the little kids are just, there's so little left over when it's time for you and your spouse. When you have teenagers, so little often left over because they just drain you and you're like, hey, let's get together and hang out and go to dinner and let's gripe about our teenagers. Well, that's romantic, isn't it? That's a great way. But that's what you end up doing a lot of the time because you got to talk to somebody about it and there's no one else to talk. So you do that. And so to recognize, you have to be intentional about setting aside emotional energy when you have it and setting it aside or saying no to things so that there's some emotional energy left. And the things that feed into your emotional energy, especially if it's the same thing for both of you, you schedule that. You make sure that's a part of your life and make that happen. So those are some great, that's meant to be very practical. It doesn't matter whether it's romantic in the offset. It will be romantic when you do it. We were amazed. So for our 20th, so 2 years ago, I plan all our trips and that kind of stuff, but Ginger asked Ginger to plan our 20th. Since she's not here, I'll tell you, because I planned a trip and she vetoed it. So I was like, okay, good, then you plan a trip for us. What she did is, which was perfect for us, she goes, what do you want to do on a trip? And I said, nothing. That's what I want to do on the trip. I want nothing. Like, I want us to go somewhere where no one expects anything of either of us. Like there's zero schedule. Like, no one knows where we are at any given time. We don't have to be anywhere at any time. That's what I want for a trip. And I was shocked. She found a house on a peninsula in Michigan where no one knew us, and we went and stayed there, and we slept 17 hours a day. It was crazy how tired we were, and we had no idea we were that tired. And it was fantastic to get that. We went and we would go to bed when we felt like it and sleep until we woke up, which I haven't done for 16 years. I mean, except when we go on trips, and we do this periodically. By the way, I recommend an evening together per week minimum, 15 to 30 minutes a day, an evening a week, a weekend at least twice a year, and more than one night away, just the two of you, once a year. I think those are just a successful general guidelines. You could do more, but I think those are good, successful general guidelines. It's amazing how often couples come into my counseling office and say, we fight all the time, and how often I will say, when was the last time you guys went on a vacation, just the two of you? And a lot of times it's never. But what's interesting to me are the times when they say, actually, last year we went on a vacation for 4 days somewhere, just the two of us. I say, how'd that go? And they will say, oh, it was amazing. We loved it. Like, you didn't fight the whole time? No, we didn't. I hadn't thought about that. We're like, right, because it turns out you like each other. You just don't ever get each other. It's never just you. It's like you don't ever get any time with your spouse, just them not doing. And so it takes a day to detox from life. And so I really strongly recommend that. And you have to discipline it. And the last part of this, did I talk about boring marriages last time? I couldn't remember because that's in our blog. If you don't know, right now on our website there are blogs posting. There are things on marriage being posted. Our CMT, our campus ministry team, each of them published a article on how to have a great marriage. So I know Kevin and Ayer Carswell's posted this last week. And then there's one from me. And then some weeks there's also one from another member of the staff. And I mean, we'd love to keep it up for some great practical marriages. So my one this week was on boring marriages, so I wasn't sure if I'd said it or just read it. But the if you have a boring marriage, it's because you're a boring person, not because you're married to a boring person. That's the rule. So one of my favorite tricks in counseling is if somebody says, I'm no longer in love with my spouse, which they always tell, I say that in counseling, like that's a big shock. Like, I'm no longer in love with my wife. Like, right? I mean, you're here. It's almost never do people come in and say, hey, we wanted to schedule a counseling hour with you and we're just crazy about each other. I mean, we just love our, so tell us something. Like, no, that would be so nice. If any of you want to do that, feel free to do that. But no, by definition, if they come, that usually means something's going wrong. And so I don't love my spouse anymore. Like, right, what else? And so they think that told the whole story. And that doesn't make you special. That makes you married. Sometimes you're in love with your spouse. Sometimes you're not. That doesn't impress me. So very often I will say, so let's say I have a husband, I'm not in love with my wife anymore, and I will say, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get on your phone, let's look at your calendar, and let's figure out a weekend you have available, say 6-8 weeks out. And so we'll find a weekend, and I'll say, okay, book that weekend. Now I want you to text your wife or call your wife right now and have her book that weekend. Just tell her, listen, don't put anything on that weekend. That's it. Just don't do anything else. Just tell her. And so they'll call and do that. And I'll go, now here's what we're going to do. You and I are going to strategize the weekend of her life. We're going to strategize the perfect weekend for her, you and I. We're going to figure that out. And so we're going to have to find out what her favorite things are and what she enjoys. And we're going to talk to friends and we're going to have to figure out the best place to go. And we're going to have to figure out what your budget is. We're going to have to do all that kind of stuff. And we're going to plan out this awesome weekend for your wife. And you get to go too, but it's for your wife. And a lot of times he'll be like, I just told you I don't like her and I don't want to spend the weekend with her. Like, that's non-negotiable. You're going and that's what we're going to plan. And here's what's wild. So I'll give them a list of homework assignments. Go do this, go do this, go do this, and bring this back next week. And they do it. And then they come back the next week. And if they do it, and I give them more, and they come back the next week, and we strategize, and we create this great weekend that they are creating, strategizing with their money, their time, their energy, all that kind of stuff, this weekend for their spouse. Guess what happens over 4 or 5 weeks of trying to create a weekend like that? What does Jesus teach us about treasure and heart? Where our treasure is, our heart will follow, right? So it'd be cute and very New Agey and kind of Oprah-y if it was where our heart is, our treasure will follow. That's probably if we were a noble race, that's what it would look like. But we're not. The truth is, wherever we put our treasure, our heart follows it. It just does. And what happens is very often there's not much treasure left to invest in your spouse, and we're not intentional with what treasure we do have, and so we're not investing time or money or energy or strategy or thought into our spouse, and big shock, our heart drifts from them to someplace else. Maybe not even someone else, but just someplace else. Our heart becomes more fascinated by work or Farmville or Facebook or something. It drifts from it because that's where we're putting our time and energy and focus and we start putting, and they fall in love with their spouse over the next month. And here's what's wild. Their marriage satisfaction score will go up. Their spouse knows nothing about this. Their spouse isn't behaving any differently. They don't know squat. And yet, because they are investing their treasure in their spouse, their heart begins to chase that treasure. And so I tell men who I disciple about having great marriages, one rule is you are always, always working on a project for your wife. Always working on a project for her. You're creating a photo album, you're creating a timeline, you're creating a trip, you're writing a poem, you're planning. Always have a long-term something you're working on for your spouse to keep your energy in that direction so that as you're thinking about that and strategizing about that, your treasure goes there and your heart naturally follows. It just does. And so it is romantic and yet mostly just pragmatic. Any questions about all that as well? About and being intentional about the margin that you do have and what you do with it? I've either lost all of you or I've taught this so well that you've just nailed it. Yes, ma'am. So generally, and I'm sure I stole this from somebody. I seem to recall Dobson having something similar to this. His was like 15 minutes a day, 2 hours a week. But so 15 to 30 minutes of time every day would be awesome. It's not going to happen every day. And by the way, this means the two of you. minimal distractions. So 15 to 30 minutes a day. By the way, one of the ways we found, that Ginger and I have found that we love to do at that time is I read out loud to her. So we have a deal. I like to read, and she has good fingernails. So I read, and she scratches. That's the deal we make. I read, she scratches. And so we've read through in our marriage. We went through a little phase where we couldn't find a good book. It was kind of a bummer. Like 2 or 3 years, we'd start like 2 or 3 chapters, and then, we just found some new ones we're reading again. But I'm telling you, in 20 years, we've read the entire Lord of the Rings series twice. We read all of the Harry Potter books out loud to her, all of the Narnia books. I mean, it's unreal the amount of, when you're married a long time and you're reading almost every day, the volume of literature you work through over time is impressive. But one of the cool things about that is, one, there's no pressure to sit there and go like, oh, what do we need to talk about? I should be thinking of something for us to talk about, and I can't think of anything for us to talk about. That takes the pressure off, and a lot of times it leads into conversation anyway, and that's which is really good. We've found that it's also good for, like, even in, like, when we have a fight, to be able to reference back to a book and, like, you know, I feel like this character out of this book when you talk to me that way. And it's actually become it creates a common experience, a common narrative for us, which has been really nice. So that's the little bit of time every day. A little bit extended time, maybe a couple of hours of focused attention every week, whether that's a date night, it can be at home, but it's got to be undivided, relatively undivided, undistracted time. And then an overnight, at least twice a year, I recommend. And 4 times a year is better, actually twice as good, and that doesn't always work out that way, but in this case, I would say it does. You could overdo that as far as you've got too many things at home, but if you can do it. And I will tell you, I found one, a lot of times, if you will just ask, you know people who have lake houses and stuff like that that you could go stay in for free. And you ask in your Sunday morning life group or in your life group class, like, does anybody have a place where we could go stay for a night? And it's amazing. People are like, yeah, that's why I bought this place. No one ever uses it, though. It's amazing how often that's the case. So that's one. I became a big fan of Priceline at one point, that you could just, like, it's Friday at noon. I'm going to get a 4-star hotel for $60 in Dallas, and that's where we will go. It doesn't have to be super expensive to do those things. And Ginger's favorite, we used to do a date when I was a seminary, a date every week at Taco Bueno. Every week we had a Bueno date on Wednesdays at lunch. And if you ask Ginger today what some of her favorite dates from our whole marriage have been, she would say the Bueno dates are one of her favorites. And then I recommend every year, if possible, more than one night away. So 2 or 3 nights away, just the two of you, I'm a big fan of as well. Good. Any other questions on that stuff? Okay, I thought about saving this until Shannon was here, and I think we will still want to get Shannon's input, and I'll probably talk about it again. But if those of you who don't know me, as a therapist, this is one of the, usually this is when my wife starts looking worried when I start talking about this stuff. But as a therapist, I talk about sex all the time in counseling. Sex is a big part of everyone's life, and it's always a big part of everyone's marriage. And so it's either a good, positive part of marriage, as old Dr. Phil says, if your marriage is a great marriage, then sex represents 10% of your marriage, and if your marriage is struggling, it represents 90%. But there's a sense in which sexuality is a barometer and a thermometer of what's going on in a marriage. And so Shannon is one of the few people I know who is even more unfiltered in talking about sexuality, which is part of why I will be on mic when she's here, just in case. But she's a little bit of a loose cannon, which is why I want her here to answer questions, but at the same time, there's a little bit of a, I may be up going up with David like, cut her mic. No, I'm teasing. I don't think I'd do that. So people ask questions regularly about sexuality stuff. And this, by the way, this plays very much so, the whole margin thing plays very much so into that. If you haven't heard them, you can hear in detail the talks that I did about a year ago here on 2 Wednesday nights, and all I talked about was the issues of sexuality within marriage and the fact that typically, this is not universal, but typically women don't identify themselves with sexuality a lot, and typically men do, and so that's kind of a basic, like, most of the time if you pursue a man sexually, he feels like you're pursuing him. Like, intuitively, she wants me. Whereas most women intuitively think he wants sex, And so there's creates this dichotomy of like, does he want me or does he just want sex? And men don't think that way because we integrate into our identity. Now, I will tell you, it is definitely true that very often that if a woman does not have a lot of sexual trauma in her past, that very often her identity and her sexuality are much more aligned. But the truth is, it's so rare nowadays for a woman to not have any sexual trauma in her past that I don't get to see that very often. And so usually it takes a lot of energy for her to bring those together. Now, that being said, so very often that's how this plays out, is that she doesn't have the emotional energy to initiate, sometimes not even to engage in sexuality, because she's worn out. She's tired, especially with young kids or teenagers. She may be worn out, and the problem is, when something comes naturally to you, it requires very little emotional energy. This doesn't mean you don't engage emotionally. That's the fact that the idea that men don't engage with sex emotionally is such raw nonsense, and there's absolutely no statistics to back that. And in fact, all the statistics massively fight against that. That in fact, maybe it's much more likely that men engage more emotionally in sexual encounters than women do. But that's all just lies. You've all been taught that. I know, because I do a premarital counseling test, and on the treatment, I've now done it 30 or 40 times, 30 or 40 couples, and I think 100% of the time, the question, men can have a satisfactory sex life without having an emotional engagement with their partner, that question, 100% of women have agreed with that statement, and not a single man has ever agreed with that statement, because we know that that's not the case. We're taught that's the case, and most of us as men think we must be the weird exception. Like, well, apparently all other guys can, but gosh, I don't feel that way. Well, it turns out just because no one feels that way. In fact, about 3% of the male population can do that, according to Shanti Felden's research, that about 3% of men don't care whether the woman engages emotionally in regards to their sexuality. She doesn't say this, but 1% of men are narcissists, 1% of men are sociopaths, and then 1% of men are schizophrenics. So there's your 3%, probably. That's not what it means. It doesn't mean not to engage emotionally. It means if it comes naturally to you, it doesn't require a lot of emotional energy to start. And that's what makes it hard. So if you can have other reasons that can cause it to require a lot of emotional energy to start, but for women typically, if they're out of energy, they don't want to engage sexually because they're out of energy and it costs points to start. It may be worth more points in the long run, but like I usually use as an example, if I tell you I will give you $50,000 if you'll bring me $1,000 in cash, all of you think that's a good idea, but probably none of you have $1,000 in cash on you. And so no matter how much I bump it up, okay, I'll give you $1,000,000. I'm not helping. By trying to motivate you with more on the other side, that doesn't help. I still don't have the $1,000 to start with. And so that's very often what women will feel like, is I would love to engage sexually. I just don't think I can. And the man is going, what? You want to, but you can't? I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. I'm totally exhausted too. That's why I want to. That sounds like an awesome way to reconnect. Oh my gosh, that would be the perfect way to deal with an exhaustion. And she's going like, no, that's going to cost 20 points and I'm at negative 10. And so there's not that energy there. And so he's got to help her find a way to either find that energy, or she has to learn to set aside some energy in order to seduce her husband on a regular basis. And that's always the case. So this question figures, this question I got this week still applies to this. So marriage is about sacrificing to create the best situation for somebody else. That's really what marriage is. I've told you guys, it's to create the garden for someone else, to create a garden experience, an Eden experience for the other person. That's what I think what marriage is, we're supposed to try to create. That's because marriage is a living parable of God's love for his people. God's love for his people is defined by sacrifice. Therefore, sacrifice is an absolutely necessary part of all marriages. What do you sacrifice for? To create the garden experience for your spouse. Got that? Here's the question I was asked. Are there any types of sex that are forbidden in Scripture? So for me, this is not a hard question because I don't mind talking about this. For you, it's a terrifying question because you're uncomfortable with me talking about a question like this. And so kind of it will diffuse. The fact that it's church makes it worse. Somehow makes this more tough conversation for you. It doesn't for me either. I literally will have to probably do a little filtering, but I'm not doing that for me. I really just don't want to unnecessarily offend anybody. But I think we in America have this impression, that the Bible is squeamish. That, like, the Bible doesn't talk about some things because, I mean, this is Jesus, right? Y'all seen that video that where they redubbed Jesus' words? And Jesus is going around calling out the sins of everybody. You smoked a cigarette and you said a naughty word after you hit your hand with a hammer. It's a riot. I mean, it's painful to watch because it's so, how many, so many. And my favorite one is the one he goes to, one he goes, and Philip, I think it's Philip. And Philip, you know what you did, but I can't say it because I'm Jesus. And so I think that's our impression, is that somehow the Bible is this squeamish, like kind of scrubbed clean book, like, So we don't know what the Bible thinks about oral sex because it doesn't say anything about oral sex. And by the way, that was my wife's introduction to being married to a therapist, was in a Sunday school class, and I am teaching from the passage in Proverbs that references where the man is saying, where Solomon is writing, and he says to his son, you know, rejoice in the breast of the wife of your youth and make sure you drink from your own cistern. And I said, this is probably not a veiled reference to oral sex being talked about here. To drink from your own cistern is probably not a really... And I said that, and I looked up, and my wife had this, like, look on her face. And I said, or maybe I shouldn't say oral sex in a Sunday school class. Like maybe that's not okay. I didn't know. I'm a counselor. I talk about this stuff all the time. But this is a... And I think that's our mind. And so whatever type of sex... This is a... In that survey that I do for pre-marriage, it lists, like... Some of you guys have taken this test. Travis, you took this test, didn't you? Did you take that sexual attitude survey, the 70 question? Oh, yeah. Isn't that fun? And it asks about everything. If you do premarital with me, it asks about everything. And what it asks is, what is your attitude about this? How do you feel about this? And it lists different positions and different types of sex and that kind of stuff, like all this. And you know, they're filling this out. And they come back in, they're like, I couldn't believe that questionnaire. And so that's why we wait until right before they get married to do that part. Because I don't want to trigger anything. So this were, as you're asking, so the part of the conversation we have to have is, the Bible is not squeamish. The Bible forbids what it wants to forbid. We didn't invent things like oral sex in the 1960s. I promise you, if there is a way to engage sexually between any two or three or four people, Solomon did it. I'm 100% sure that Solomon has had sexual experiences that Johnson & Johnson never has thought of and couldn't put in a book if they wanted to. Like, this is something that he knew better than anyone. He had 300 sex slaves and 700 wives, and this is not someone who is unfamiliar with engaging sexually, and there are no limits. There's no telling what Esther experienced with King Xerxes in their one night together, because this is Xerxes' God on earth, and they didn't have any limitations about the way they engaged sexually at all. This is not something we invented at some point. So sexual perversion has been around for as long as human beings have been around, and probably all expressions of sexuality that you can creatively come up with. And here's what's wild. The Bible is not squeamish. In Leviticus 18... is the passage that any first century person who knew about, who was referencing sexual immorality, this is the section, when Jesus says that you should avoid sexual immorality, any first century rabbi would be referencing Leviticus 18. And Leviticus 18 very clearly forbids certain sexual practices. And the problem is, we're under the impression that the ones it doesn't forbid, it's because whoever wrote Leviticus didn't know about these. That the Holy Spirit was too squeamish to say them. Like, and don't do that thing, you know what I mean, but I can't say it, type of, that's not the case at all. You are not squeamish. If you read, if it opens up, I may reference some of it. But in Leviticus 18, you get things like, don't have sex with your uncle. Don't have sex with the woman who your dad is married to. Don't have sex with your sister's husband. I mean, this is... And by the way, it lists adultery. It lists homosexuality. Don't do this. This is sexual immorality. Don't do this. That would be bad. It's not squeamish. If you're talking bestiality, you're not squeamish. If you're saying specifically, don't have sex with an animal, that would be bad. You're not squeamish. If you've gone there for that part of the conversation, the sexual attitude survey I give, it doesn't even do that. It doesn't reference this. It is very clear. By the way, it even references, essentially it says, don't put your children on the altar to Molech. Molech was a god who was sexually aroused by the burning of children. And so this was, don't even try to sexually arouse a god. And so this is, Leviticus 18 is very clear, and it's not squeamish. And here's what's interesting. It does not forbid anything between a husband and a wife that doesn't involve other people. Not a thing. And so the question, the person who asked the question was like, I'm curious what passages talk about it. And my answer is, what's most intriguing to me is that there aren't passages talking about it. That, believe me, if the Bible specifically forbids so many things, if it wanted to specifically forbid any behavior between a husband and a wife, I am 100% confident it would. There was even an error made in New Testament translation, or at least application for a while, that the word sodomy meant the penetration of any orifice other than the female orifice, right? And so that was what was, and so that for that reason, many other types of sex were considered illegal in the United States. Not surprisingly, those have all been knocked down by the Supreme Court by now. But this is the problem was, that was a misinterpretation and mistranslation of the New Testament. The word there, sodomy, it means the sharing of sperm between men. It's actually the Greek. And so it has nothing, that passage, that word has nothing to do with a husband and a wife. It cannot apply to a male and a female at all, but it certainly has nothing to do with a husband and a wife. You are literally left with, biblically, with this is the understanding. Does it involve anyone other than the husband and the wife? If the answer to that is yes, it is forbidden. Any sexuality that involves anyone other than the husband and the wife is forbidden. That certainly is going to mean pornography. It's certainly going to mean any other people. Those are going to be forbidden scripturally. That would be adultery at some form or another. And animals aren't allowed either, apparently. And so as long as it's a legal marriage. Now, except for that, and by the way, the only case you can make from Leviticus 18 and anything else has to do with menstruation, as to whether or not sex is allowed during that time. For the Jews, that was a time of ritual uncleanness, and therefore they weren't allowed to do anything involved with ritual uncleanness. It's hard to know whether that would directly apply over morally to us, but because it's about ritual uncleanness, which we no longer are under ritual uncleanness, but it's the only argument you can make that something between a husband and a wife would not be okay. That's the only thing listed in there. That's it. Now, that being said, it does tell us, in 1 Corinthians, we get this conversation in 6 and 7 about sexuality by Paul. And the measurement for Paul about sexuality seems to be twofold. One is, often, a husband and wife need to be engaging often in sexuality. But as is typical of the Bible, it's not going to tell us, well, how much is often? Because we would abuse, anytime the Bible gives us any type of clear number like that, we abuse it. I mean, we start immediately abusing it. Like, so I see it says, I mean, we start using that to just hammer the other person in the marriage. And but God, I mean, it's inappropriate. So the word is often, the idea here is off regularly. You can fast from it, but not for long. Because you need to come back together. That's part of it. Paul saw all of this as a character weakness on our part, but that's okay. That's a separate issue. As a gift God hadn't given us because we burned with lust for one another. So that's one. The second one is, it says that they should fast and come back together, quote, by mutual assent. Mutual consent, excuse me. That this is something they should agree to. And I think this is a principle that applies in regards to sexuality in general. That is clearly not the specific application Paul is making, but I think that's a fair one, especially given that marriage is about sacrifice. So that you would say, if the other person is not comfortable with that or does not want that or is not interested in whatever that happens to be, then you wouldn't. This isn't some, you know, you're going to miss out forever on something that just you can't live without. There's nothing about sex. Sex is not a need. There's nothing about sex that is a need. That's just a lie we tell ourselves to justify our bad behavior. Sex is not a need. And so in regards to this, what I would say is between a husband and a wife, nothing is forbidden scripturally. Maybe that one case is the only thing you could argue. And beyond that, as long as it doesn't involve anybody else, and as long as there's mutual consent, something that both people are willing and interested in doing, it is not forbidden. I cannot find any scriptural evidence or any scriptural reference to say otherwise. I never have. and this has become more and more often the teaching about sexuality, the scriptural teaching about sexuality, is this. There was a time, and you could find old writings that talk about things being natural or unnatural, and what's so ironic about that is that the Bible says that the natural man can't be trusted. And so that would not even be a good biblical argument, even if that was the case, and there's no indication that that's the case. We don't build our morality based on animals. We build our morality based on Scripture. Now, I will ask if there are any questions. I cannot imagine that any of you are willing to ask a question after that. But if you are, I mean, go for it. If you've got any questions about it, I'm not squeamish, and I'm happy to talk about it. But I will be honest, I will be super impressed if someone's like, yeah, I got one. But anybody? Heck no. Okay, good. Any other questions about another topic? Total other topic you would like for me to... Everybody need to shake off the adrenaline after I talked about that. I used some words that you would be like, woo, gosh. So, yes, ma'am?
You were talking about emotional energy.
Yes.
Great question.
How do you set aside emotional energy? You got to know what costs you emotional energy, okay? So what is an expense? Think of it as accounting. What is an expense and what is a deposit? And so you want to encourage the things that deposit more energy into your life. And most of, so like for a newlywed couple, very often that's not a problem at all because they've got emotional energy just kind of lying around, right? Now, it's not always the case. There may be reasons why not. There could be illness or sickness or something like that that could be, and by the way, by definition, a depressed person does not have much emotional energy. That's what depression means. It means to be pushed down, to not have much emotional energy, and that's a big part of what that means. You don't have much of that to give. But, so rest is often a good one. Exercise sometimes is a good one. Getting quiet and alone and sitting and reading is often a good one. If you have a good, to the degree you have an intimate relationship with somebody, that person costs less emotional energy. People who are you don't know very well, or who even worse you know and you don't like, those cost a lot of emotional energy. So if it's someone who are very, very different from you, they can cost you a lot of emotional energy if you have to be around them a lot. Those are all the case. A job, there are certain things within jobs that can cost you emotional energy. So part of it is you need to know. And it doesn't mean, by the way, that something can build emotional energy for you that costs you physical energy. So for Wednesday, today, there's been a series, a little bit of time now, where I've taught at the Boys and Girls Club at 8:30 and then taught at a MOPS or something like that after that before lunch. And then I have Women Area at 1:30 to 3:30. It's a two-hour teaching. And then I do this. Teaching requires very little emotional energy from me. So I will, at Wednesday night, I'll get home and emotionally I will be like ding, ding. I mean, like I'm like glowing by emotional energy. I've had so much, but I'm toast. I mean, physically, I'm just like, I'm going to fall down now. And so those don't necessarily go hand. That's what we see Jesus experience with the woman at the well. So Jesus is exhausted and I think he's exhausted and introverted. Therefore, he sends his disciples away. I've always think that's a funny scene where he's like, you guys go into town and get some food. And you can imagine them saying, well, it doesn't take all of us to go get food. And we're like, all of you, food, go. Get away from here. I'm on some time alone. I just, not subtle. And so there's not a boat. We're in Samaria. There's not a boat for me to escape on. All of you go away. And every time I teach this, I say this line. So some of you probably heard me. But so if you're a good introvert, you know what happens when you finally get time to yourself. Someone interrupts you. And so the woman comes up and they have that whole conversation. Well, the disciples, when they left Jesus, apparently he was exhausted and maybe extremely hungry, because when they come back, they're freaked out by the fact that he's one talking to a woman and a Samaritan. But then what happens is they ask a question and he teaches them and they say, did you get some food somewhere? Like, you're all hyped up now. I mean, you're all excited and in a good mood now. And we left, you were chasing us off with sticks. And what happened? And he goes, I have a food that you know nothing about. Okay, that's an emotional energy. That's a spiritual energy type of thing where he's like, no, I'm charged up because I just watched a person go from death to life. And I know what that's going to mean. And yes, I'm still tired and I'm going to fall asleep in a storm in a boat later tonight. But that's, other than that, I am, that's the... Those two things don't have to go hand in hand, if that answers the question. So you need to know, what are those things? And that's one of the cool things. Here's a question I ask in premarital counseling. This would be a great thing no matter where you are in your marriage to ask the question. What is a chore or a task around the house that you hate? There's usually one that you just hate. Nope, just one. You got to pick one. The one thing you hate. It can be for absolutely ridiculous reasons. So for me, I hate putting a trash bag back in the trash can in the kitchen. I mean, I just hate it. Every time I do, I have this running narrative of like, I took the trash out. Someone else can put a blasted bag back in the trash. I mean, I did all this and no one can, and you know, especially when you go to it and there's trash in the can and no one's put a bag in it. And you're like, I took this out and they couldn't be bothered to. Anyway, so I have this like, I'm this knee-jerk hair trigger reaction in my brain, ready to go. So I hate that. Ginger hates toilets. She just, if she didn't have to have them to go to the bathroom, there wouldn't be one in our house. I mean, she's grossed out by them. And so we decided, and early on in our marriage, she said to me, you will never, ever, for the rest of your life, have to put a bag in the trash can. I'll do it. For the rest of your life, you never, ever again have to. I can choose to, but I don't have to. I could call her from another part of the house that I'm standing right there over the trash can and say the trash can needs a new trash bag, and with great joy she will put a trash bag in and go, I'm so happy I could do that for you, right? And she never for the rest of her life has to clean a toilet. Especially now that we have kids, she doesn't have to because I make them do it. But this is I don't mind that. I am not squeamish at all about human beings, and so that doesn't bother me a bit. I worked in a psych hospital with Alzheimer's patients, and it doesn't take much of that before a normal dirty toilet just doesn't trigger. I mean, it just doesn't even like, yeah, that's not a big deal. I've done worse, so I don't even want to talk about it. That I don't want to talk about. But so you can, that's a way, so that's something that, because putting a trash bag in the trash can doesn't really require any energy. But for some reason, it taxes me emotionally to put a trash bag in the trash. Actually, I do know why, but I'm not going to go into it now. For some reason, it taxes her extra to do that. Well, if I do that, that may cost me 3 or 4 points of emotional energy, but it might cost her 30. So if I can do it and save her 30 points of emotional energy, man, that's a bargain for me to do that. And so part of the job for the husband and the wife is to be constantly on the lookout. What are the things that, again, best invest what little energy I have, what little extra I have, what little margin I have, to take that off of her plate or his plate? Because here's the deal. That's how that works. It may cost you 2 or 3 points of energy and save her 30. And she might can do something and save him 30. And if there's something like that, of course it makes sense for them to do that if they plan on having any energy together at the end of the evening. To do what doesn't come naturally to them. By the way, that doesn't just mean sex. So I am a multitasker. I think I told you all this way. I'm a multitasker. I like doing 2 or 3 things at a time. So naturally, I married a woman whose love language is not just quality time. It is undivided attention. If my attention is divided from 98%, the meter isn't running. The meter runs for her heart if I am 100% focused on her. And she loves that when I just spend an undivided attention. Me, who, I mean, right now, John and Lance would be like internally going like, Mark, how many years in a row has the CMT's feedback for me in my annual evaluation been, do your best to focus better on people when they're in your office like that. Like 3 or 4 years in a row, and I don't fight, do I? I'm like, yes, I know, I need to work on that so bad. But that's not, so of course, naturally, I'm married to a woman who the meter doesn't start until she's got all my attention. And if she's got all my attention and I'm talking to her for 6 or 7 minutes and I reach over and start folding laundry, she stops talking like, oh. go start back. I'm reaching. She starts talking and I'm going like, so we got, and then she stopped talking again. No, go ahead. Like, it does, if she needs my undivided attention, that's what she needs. And that's, I'm not wired that way. Oh, I'm going to save you from a divorce here real quick. So here's one of the ways this plays out. If it comes naturally, here's what this means. Catch this. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I almost forgot this. So, naturally she says, hey, it really means a lot to me when you focus some attention. Like when you just sit down with just me or look at just me or whatever and don't do anything else. And so I go, because I'm a good husband, I go, you know what, you're right, I'm going to do better at that. And I do. Until I don't. Because what we do is, it requires a lot of energy for me to focus all of my attention like that. And so I focus all of my attention like that, but if I have a day of low energy, or just naturally over time, what do? I slowly go back to what comes naturally. Welcome to the human race. We slowly go back to what comes naturally for us. And the more challenging we are, the more tired we are, the more energy we don't have, the less energy we have to not naturally go back to what comes naturally to us. You follow me? What this means is, when you come to counseling and you say, I've told him 1,000 times that this is important to me, I shouldn't have to tell him again, my answer is, oh yeah, you should. I suspect every 4 to 6 months you'll have to for the rest of your life. And the more stress you've got going on, it may be every 3rd week. Because people get mad. They're like, how come she doesn't remember this is important to me? How come he doesn't know that this is important to me? We fought about the same things 20,000 times. Right, you and every other married couple. That's what marriage is going to do. It is going to be like that. The goal is that you would say, I mean, you should be ecstatic if you come to them. So one is, don't be defensive when your spouse comes to you. So my wife comes to me and says, I feel like you're not paying very good attention to me. I mean, does it really make any sense at all for me to say, what are you talking about? I mean, Tuesday, I remember I sat on the couch and I've just, am I really that unaware of myself that I shouldn't go, yeah, that sounds like me. Oh, you're saying I'm not paying good attention just to you? Yeah, me, yeah, mm-hmm. I bet that was me. That shouldn't be some huge surprise to us. Of course that happens. There's nothing to defend there. And so I will make adjustments. Oh my gosh, yes. And I'll put something in place and I'll create a pattern. I'm like, you know what? We're going to walk to the pond every day. That's what we're going to do. You and I'm going to come home and we're going to tell the kids to go to their room and you and I are going to walk down to the pond and we're going to throw some bread to the fish and then we're going to walk back up to the house. Won't that be great? That would be awesome. And so we do that. And the second day we do it. And the 3rd day we do it. And the 4th day we don't do it. And the 5th day we do, and the 6th day we don't, and the 7th day we don't, and the 8th day we do, and then a week goes by and we don't, and then I remember it and we do it once, and then 6 months later she's going, you know what, it was really special to me when we would walk down to the pond. I'm going, right, pond, golly, but yes, we'll go do that. And by the way, and the same thing's going to happen the other direction. Hey, sweetie, this is something that's important to me. You remember that? And I can either get mad and go like, how come we're always having to talk about this? Or I can say, hey, you know this thing that doesn't come naturally to you? That is still important to me, and so that would be awesome. If you could be reminded. And that's not a fight if we're able to say, oh yeah, right, that makes sense. I knew that. I'll do better. And when the person says, I'll do better, you just need to interpret in your head like, you will for a while, and then you won't. And then I can gently and kindly remind you, and then you can again. And in the meantime, you can remind me, and I'll try to remember. That's one of the advantages of being a counselor and a pastor is somebody comes in and go like, oh, my husband just never pays any attention to me. And I'm like, oh, I haven't paid attention to Ginger. They're like, what are you writing about me? I'm not writing anything about you. Pay attention to my wife. Like that's a text Ginger as soon as she leaves. You'd be surprised how often my notes do say something like that on there. That hopefully that will save you from this feeling of like, how come I'm consistently being abused on the same matters? One, you're probably not being abused, although some of you may be, but you're probably not being abused. But the truth is, that's how it's going to happen. We as human beings live according to the law of undulation. We go up and we go down and we go up and we go down and we go up and we go down. And so we try hard and then we lose our energy, we lose our focus, something distracts us, something gets hard, we get sick, or we get tired, or we get injured, or someone dies, or something gets hard at work, or one of the kids is freaking out, and that distracts us, and we forget, and we don't notice. So keep in mind, you've got ruts, you get out of the rut, and you do something different, and then something happens, and it jars you back into those little ski ruts. Notice that nothing naturally is going to bring you out of those. So again, you're going to have to go, oh, right, I've got to make the effort to get out of what comes naturally to me because that's not what my spouse needs. And just spouses understand, guess what, over time, something's going to happen. It's going to knock them back in there, and they're not likely on their own to notice that because that feels natural to them. That feels easiest to them. That feels best to them. So hopefully that saved you a bunch of pain. A few of us will be in the Dominican Republic next week. Pike will be here to share, and so I hope you will come. I don't even know what he's going to share about, so that will be awesome. Come back in and hear Pike next Wednesday night. And then the next Wednesday night, when we get back, we'll be, Shannon will be here on the 27th. And then I don't even remember. The next Wednesday night is the family fun night celebration. So then I guess in November will hopefully be when we finish Mark. We'll see. We'll see. So let me pray. Father, thank you so much that you created marriage. It is a proof of your existence that it exists, I believe. And if it exists the way that it does, so that if two people will seek to sacrifice their own lives for the sake of somebody else's because they love you, and if both of them will do that, it's like almost like heaven on earth. So God, I pray that you will help us to each be excellent spouses, to be excellent husbands and excellent wives, and thus creating excellent marriages. I pray that this would be a church where people have cutting-edge, world-class marriages. Marriages that last and stick and that grow and get better. Not perfect. None of us are going to have perfect marriages, but awesome, growing, thriving, working hard marriages. Because God, I know that the world is desperate for help in marriage. And if we had a church full of people who are working hard to make marriage real, to try to create a Garden of Eden experience for another person, because that's what you call. That's what you call us to, God, that you would call us to live as a living sacrifice to you and in our first ministry to our spouse. Man, I know we'd probably have to lock the doors to keep people out. So God, I pray you would continue to lead us and teach us and grow us so that our marriages are living parables of your love for your people. I ask this all in your Son's magnificent name and through the power of your Spirit, because marriage is a miracle. When it goes well, it's a miracle. So we ask it in your Son's name. Amen.